Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Titus Kennedy, on archaeological evidence for over 100 biblical characters.
These people in the Bible, like David and Hezekiah and Sennacherib and Nebuchadnezzar, just so many of the kings of Judah, as well as earlier people and later people in the New Testament, you know, Pilate and Jesus and Herod the Great and so forth.
Titus Kennedy next. Even though believers take it on faith that the people named on the pages of the Bible really existed, did you know archaeological discoveries continue to provide ancient evidence for the historical reality of their existence? Coming up next, Spencer Dahlke talks with Dr. Titus Kennedy, author of Archaeology and the People of the Bible, exploring the evidence for the historical existence of Bible characters.
Just by way of getting to know you a little bit, would you tell us a little bit about how God led you into the field of archaeology?
It started at a young age. I always liked history. I liked languages. I liked science, but I had no idea that archaeology existed. And then on a school field trip, they took us to this old fort from the 1800s, and I was pretty surprised that it was still standing, because I thought old buildings were like 50 years old, not 150 or so. The next summer, my family was on vacation in Hawaii, and for some reason, my dad took us to this ancient Hawaiian village that they had excavated, and they did some reconstruction. So then I really clearly saw how archaeology had happened, that this place was at least partially buried under the ground, and they exposed that, and they learned new things about these people and where they lived. That next year in school, my teacher gave me a book on the excavation of Troy, the discovery and excavation of Troy. And so then I really read about archaeology and saw the word archaeology, and it was described how they did this. And that just opened up the world of archaeology to me. And I realized that we weren't just being passed down information on pages of books, but that people were sometimes going out there and locating these ancient ruins and then digging into the ground and discovering them and new information. As I got older, I read more books on archaeology, and I was given some on archaeology of the Bible. And that's when I learned that there are so many discoveries from archaeology that connect to the Bible. Some just help us to understand the ancient context, the world of the Bible better, and others confirm its historical accuracy. And I found that fascinating and just continued to have an interest in that, and then eventually decided that I wanted to try to study this in college and see where it would go. So I did that, ended up doing two masters and a doctorate and working on lots of digs, and here I am today.
I understand most biblical archaeology is going to be like in the Eastern Mediterranean region and Israel and whatnot. Have you had the chance to, well, presumably you have.
Worked on 18 excavations, most of them over in the Middle East. And I lived in that region for a few years, different places. Jerusalem, of course, was one of the places. Yeah, I got to spend a lot of time over in the Bible lands. I still do. Every year I excavate, and every year I also help lead a tour, and then I also do other research. Sometimes I do filming for documentaries. So get over there, see the real stuff, learn more about it. It's a constant learning process, really. And there's new information being found all the time, too. So it's not finite. It's not like, okay, memorize these 10 books and you'll know all the discoveries. No, because even if it was possible to memorize everything that's been found, each year new things are being discovered, and we're reevaluating some past excavations as well, and we're trying to better understand what happened in ancient history.
In light of some of those new discoveries and stuff, it might be worthwhile. You mentioned, I think, somewhere in your book, it may have been in the introduction that I saw, but arguments against the Bible, I'm not super familiar. At this point in history, what do you see as some of the more common arguments being brought against the Bible, archaeology-wise?
Yeah, the common arguments are that the Bible is a fictional or mythological book. And so what they mean by that is not that every single thing in the Bible is fiction or mythology, but that there are some historical aspects and then the rest of it is fiction. And usually the historical aspects, they say, are things like geography or maybe the existence of some of the cities. But then they say that the people and the events, by and large, are often mythological or fictional. And so this is usually what gets circulated. And in the general public, then people hear that and they go, oh, yeah, it's a book of fairy tales. Maybe there's some real places, but none of that stuff happened. So you've got claims like, oh, there's no evidence that Jesus ever existed, or, you know, the whole Old Testament is basically fiction, or they just copied some stuff from the Mesopotamians. Those are pretty common. But as you mentioned, the introduction to my book, I deal with this idea a little bit by distinguishing between what is mythology in ancient texts and what is history in ancient texts. And so I use the example of the Iliad by Homer to show what mythology is and how that differs from the Bible. In the Iliad, Homer writes about this narrative of the fall of Troy. There's the battle there. The city is eventually destroyed. And Schliemann was obsessed with this, and he thought it was historical, although other people generally at the time didn't. But he thought, you know, Troy's a real place. I'm going to find it. I'm going to show that its destruction is recorded in the archaeological record. And so he did that, although he made a mistake on the date. So the place is real, and there was a destruction of Troy. And in fact, Mycenae is a real place, and other cities, there are other places mentioned in the Iliad that are real. So some event may have happened, like the war there. We're not really sure exactly. We can't really show that it was the Mycenaeans that destroyed it. In fact, I think archaeologists today would say that's unlikely. But even if we grant that, the mythological issue here is that all the people that are discussed in that poem, whether it's Agamemnon or Priam or Achilles or Hector or Paris or Helen and so forth, we have zero archaeological evidence that any of those people existed. And so there's a general historical context of these civilizations existed. Yes, these cities existed, but those people were not real people. And the events were probably not much like they're depicted in the poem, other than the city was destroyed. And then if you compare that to the Bible, it's very different. Yes, of course, we have Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Babylon and Nineveh and all these places. And then we could look at some of the destructions. Yeah, Jerusalem destroyed in 587 BC and so forth. And we see some correlations there with the Iliad. But then the big difference is that these people in the Bible, like David and Hezekiah and Sennacherib and Nebuchadnezzar, just so many of the kings of Judah, as well as earlier people and later people in the New Testament, you know, Pilate and Jesus and Herod the Great and so forth, we have archaeological evidence for all these people. I go through about 135 different people in my book, or mention them at least in some evidence. You know, the focus is on a few less than that, but that's the major difference, is we have evidence that those people existed and that the things that they did, the events that they were involved in, actually happened, evidence from that time. Whereas mythology, again, just a historical setting, the people, the stories aren't real. The Bible, the historical setting, the people are real, the events are real. So that's the difference between what people are often claiming about the Bible and the reality of it that we now can demonstrate so easily through archaeology.
Do people ever try to point to, I should ask by way of not assuming, is there evidence that, you know, ancient Israel worshipped idols? Do people ever point to that as disproof of the Bible?
Yeah, absolutely. There are some archaeologists who spend a lot of time on that, actually write books or articles about it. And they say, hey, look, we found this female figurine, or we found this idol in ancient Israel, and that therefore those people were polytheists. You know, they worship idols, they worship other gods. So the Bible is just trying to give us this propaganda that there was monotheism. But if we just read the Bible, we see that there were times, many times, unfortunately, when the Israelites did worship other gods and had idols. And then we have, you know, kings like Hezekiah and Josiah who annihilated those idols and those altars and high places and things like that and got people back on track worshiping the one true God. So really, archaeology is just showing us what the Bible is talking about, but people are trying to twist it and or ignore what the Bible itself says and construct a different narrative.
As a study, how does one do archaeology? Like, how do you interpret the things that you uncover?
It depends on what we're looking at. Obviously, what we're usually excavating is things like pottery and then some artifacts, you know, maybe coins, tools, weapons, and so forth. And then architecture. So these building stones. And we can see through design that some things are human made and some things are natural, right? If you find 10 square shaped stone blocks in a row all stuck together and then have a 90 degree corner with another 10 square stone blocks, you can see that that was probably the foundations of some building, right? So we would say, hey, here's part of the foundation of a building, and then we could measure it and we could see how big it was. And based on its size, we might be able to make some interpretations. Like a very large building is probably not going to be a house. Something with a really thick wall, again, not going to be a house. City walls tend to be very, very thick. So I'm talking about if we're just looking at a micro slice. Now, if we are able to excavate more of the site, it becomes more obvious. You kind of zoom out like you're looking down from a drone and you can see the city wall going all around the city. And it's just very obvious. And you can see these different square and rectangular shaped buildings. Now, as for the use of those buildings, we would often have to excavate inside them and see what's found. Or maybe there are other buildings just like it at other sites that we already know, okay, you know, they built a temple like this, or they built a house like this. So there are parallels, but in the initial discovery phase of all these things, you have to do things like, oh, this small building, we found in it some animal bones in a little trash pile, and we found some broken pottery here, and we found some weaving equipment there, and we found some basic tools here. This looks like it could have been a house, or like a bread oven over here. This could have been a house. And then we see something else, and it's got massive pillars, and there's really fancy decorated pottery in there, and there are some idols in there, stone idols. And we say, oh, you know, this seems like a Canaanite temple. Later on, you know, we see like mosaic floors, and there's a verse from the New Testament on it. Oh, okay, this is a church, you know. So there are some things that become very obvious, and then there are other things that require more interpretation, like, you know, what time period is this from? And over the years, archaeologists have constructed chronologies and typologies, and so we're able now to look at pieces of pottery, and we understand, okay, this specific style of pottery was made in this century, and we're finding it all over the floor of this building, and so that's when it was used. So there's interpretation, but it's not just based on whatever somebody feels like, or at least it shouldn't be, because we have so much data now that we can really distinguish between different time periods, different cultures, different uses, and then it makes the interpretation much more solid. The primary problem in archaeology actually comes with the next step, and that is the conclusions. The data we can't change, right? You dig up an artifact, it physically exists, all right? It's there, deal with it. Take a picture of it, measure it, describe it. The interpretation was like, okay, this is Egyptian because it's got hieroglyphs on it and it shows a pharaoh. And then the time period, okay, well, based on the king list, we know this pharaoh lived in the 15th century BC, right? So that's interpretation. And it's generally not something that archaeologists dispute with each other on. You know, sometimes there's a few little things here and there. But then the conclusions, you know, what does that mean for the historical record? Or, you know, how did these people live? Or what was their interaction with another culture? Or is the Bible correct about this? That's where the difference comes in. And the conclusions can be heavily clouded by personal agendas and biases. And so that's why we may see, well, like we do today, two different archaeologists who have worked on the same site, on the same gate at the same site. And one guy says, this is from the 10th century BC. It was built by Solomon. And we read about it in the Bible at this specific location. And then another guy says, no, it's from the 9th century BC. And it was built by Omri because Omri was really the first king that was real. You know, so that's what an example of how the conclusions can differ. They may not follow from the data, but it happens.
Well, my guest today is Titus Kennedy. He's assistant professor of biblical archaeology and a field archaeologist and author of Archaeology and the People of the Bible, Exploring Evidence for the Historical Existence of Bible Characters. You write about, you mentioned 130 different biblical characters that you have studied from your work. Time would fail us to talk about all of them, but I did want to ask about like at least a few, one of which was Balaam, just because he's an interesting character. Can you tell us about one, archaeologically speaking, what did we know about him until when? And what sort of evidence do we have for his existence now?
Balaam's a very interesting one because he's one of the earliest people named in the Bible for which we have really clear archaeological evidence. And there's really two reasons for this. As you go back farther in time, is we have less information or less data that survived from those early periods. Just things get destroyed over time or lost, or, you know, they also get buried deeper. And so a lot of places get excavated, but they may not excavate through the really early layers because it takes more time and work. So that's one reason. The other reason is that we don't have as much writing that survives from this early periods, especially if we're talking about any place other than Mesopotamia and Egypt. In the Levant and Israel and Canaan, there's hardly any writing from these early periods. So that's why if you look through the book, you're like, huh, there's a whole lot of people that start like around the 10th, 9th century BC. And then really in the first century, it's like everybody is known almost. But you go back earlier and not so much. So Balaam, what we have of Balaam is from Jordan, from a place or a site called Deir Allah, which we would identify with the biblical site of Sukkoth mentioned in Joshua 13. Now, so this is not the Sukkoth that's in the Exodus narrative, those two different locations, but it's on the eastern side of the Jordan River. This is the area where the Israelites were when they encountered Balaam. And this is an Aramaic text. It's actually inside, it was inside a building and the walls were plastered. And then they wrote this story on ink on the plastered walls. And part of it's been preserved. It was in a lot of different pieces when they excavated because the building crumbled, but they put together the pieces and we have some sort of a narrative. And we have Balaam, son of Beor, is specifically named. So his name, his lineage, and then his occupation, that he is a seer of the gods. So he has the same occupation. So it's the same location, same name, same family, same occupation. The time period is the only difference here. And I don't know if I should really say the time period is different, but this artifact itself is not from the time of Balaam's encounter with the Israelites. The copy of this story that we have is from about 800, 9th century BC, somewhere around there. Okay, so it's a few hundred years later, but what they probably did was they copied this and they copied it again and they copied it again. And we have a text surviving from the 9th century. You know, this is very common actually with all ancient texts. If we're not talking about stone inscriptions or clay tablets, you know, if we're talking about manuscripts of the Bible or manuscripts of Josephus or, you know, Roman historians like Tacitus or Suetonius, we don't have the copies from the time that they wrote, from the century that they wrote. We have them from centuries later. So this is kind of similar to that, but it hits on 4 of the 5 criteria that I outline in the introduction of the book. So it's quite solid. It's not the 100% rating, you know, that some of them might get, but I put it as probable. So that's what we see about Balaam. It's not about the Israelites specifically in this one. It's about some other people. We're not exactly sure who they are because some of the text is broken, but he's doing the same kind of thing that we see in the Bible. So it's definitely talking about the same person.
And at very least, it would seem to suggest that even if it does not necessarily prove him with 100% certainty, it at least suggests that it's not unreasonable to believe that this person actually did exist.
And this is a record from a people to the east of Israel. It's not the Israelites who are writing this down. So it's not like later Israelites decided to make up this story about a guy named Balaam. No, this is another people who is also attesting to his existence and his role.
There are a number of other, so many Old Testament characters, lots of New Testament characters. Just throw out Simon Peter. Presumably, I think you mentioned Peter in like your table of contents. I assume it's Simon Peter.
Yeah. Peter's another really interesting one. So this is an example of one that if you go back a few decades, you really wouldn't see anything written about his existence. And in fact, if you look at a lot of books today, you still wouldn't. And I think part of this is because of the suspicion that people have about ancient church monuments and then also the Catholic Church. So some of what was found with Peter was found in the Vatican, but some of what was found in Capernaum. Capernaum, this village on the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus based his ministry for much of the time with his disciples. We read in the Gospels, there is a synagogue there, and then really close to the synagogue, it says immediately after they came out of the synagogue, they came into the house of Peter. So there's this house of Peter, as it was actually originally his mother-in-law's house, we find out, but Peter's house, and then Peter obviously doesn't stay in Galilee. He goes out and he starts preaching the gospel, and he ends up in Rome later where he is executed. What does he do with his house? Well, it seems that he gives it to the local Christians there in Capernaum, in Galilee. And in the second half of the first century, we see archaeologically, this is no longer used as a house. It's used as some kind of gathering place. And there's a lot of oil lamps in there. And then in the second century, they start to modify the structure. And they also plaster the walls and they write things on the walls. And most of the writing is praises of Lord Jesus Christ, things like that. Okay, very common for what you would expect people in a church to be writing. But there are two inscriptions on the wall that mention Peter. So we have Peter's name. One of them's in Greek, one of them's in Latin. The one in Latin actually associates him with Rome. So they know about that connection, which probably everybody did at that point. But so we've got a couple of second century inscriptions in Peter's house mentioning him. Then if we go to Rome, there is the burial of Peter. According to early Christian texts, even going back to the second century, Peter was executed by crucifixion upside down. And this, I think, is prophesied in the Gospel of John, where Jesus basically says that Peter's going to have the same type of death as him, crucifixion. So he's crucified upside down. And how do you get a crucifixion victim off of the cross? Well, you either pull the nails out and they drop off, or you just cut off that section of the limbs that's nailed down. So if you nail him by his feet upside down, you may just cut him off at the ankles. So early Christian texts talk about his burial then. So the Christians got his body. They buried him in the area where he was crucified, which is in the Vatican today, Basilica of St. Peter. It was built there because of Peter's martyrdom and burial. So excavations then underneath the church in the 20th century ended up finding not just this graveyard from the first century and then the second century, but they found a specific burial that had an inscription next to it that says Peter inside. And they excavated in here and they found the burial with the bones of a 60-something-year-old man. And all of the bones were present from the skeleton, or I should say all sections of the skeleton were represented. You know, it wasn't 100% intact, but except for the feet, okay? So like he'd been cut off at the ankles as if he'd been crucified upside down. So we've got his name written right there, and then we have this body that looks like it had been crucified upside down. And it's in the right place where the early Christian sources say that he was buried. You know, then Constantine later on ended up building a church over that monument. And then, you know, you have the modern church as well now that's built over it. So we've got multiple inscriptions mentioning Peter as well as possibly his burial.
It's very gruesome, but I suppose that's part of what makes the job interesting. It's some of these, some of these facts and things you observe about how they were killed. Of these many, many, many people that you have studied so far, I'm curious if you think there are any particular figures from biblical history that apologetically would be important for Christians to know about.
Yeah, well, the most important one would be Jesus. So we have exceptional evidence for Jesus, actually. I mean, I wrote a whole book on the archaeology of Jesus, excavating the evidence for Jesus. But in this book that we're talking about, the section on Jesus, I really just focus in on the first century material. So we have five different authors or writers who lived in the first century who mentioned Jesus or Christ. None of them are Christians. So they're Roman, primarily Roman authors. There's a Syrian as well. But so they know about his existence. And they mentioned some things about his life too, like about the trial and the crucifixion. Josephus, of course, even mentions reports of the resurrection. He doesn't say that he believes that's what happened, but he says here's the reports of it. So from these ancient historical manuscripts, we have plenty of evidence for Jesus, but archaeological artifacts we do as well. The James Ossuary has this Aramaic inscription that says, James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus, and they almost never put the name of the brother on. Only one other ossuary inscription has the brother's name. So we know he's important, and we know that he has a brother, James, who Josephus knew the connection between Jesus Christ and James. And James has a father named Joseph, which, of course, we read about in the Gospels. And there was a statistical study done on Jerusalem at this time and the percentage use of names. And they found that it looks like less than two people would have fit that name relationship combination there. So pretty much pointing right to Jesus Christ there. So it's a first century artifact, pre-70 AD from Jerusalem. It's very strong. Then we've got a cup that was found in the harbor of Alexandria, Egypt, and it's in Greek, and it says, through Christ the magician. So it was a magical cup. They knew that Jesus Christ performed miracles, and so they thought they could harness his power because the Egyptians were really into magic. And so they would use this for some kind of magical ritual. They know about his title. And so they think they can harness it. So there's another first century artifact with his title Christ. And then in Rome, on the Palatine Hill, was discovered this drawing. It's called the Alexamenos Graffito. And it's the earliest depiction of Jesus being crucified. But it's not made by Christians. It's made by pagans who are mocking Christianity. And so they show Jesus on the cross with the head of a donkey. And it shows a Christian next to the cross, and they say Alexamenos, that's the name of the guy, worships his God. And this is from about 100 AD, okay, so end of the first century. So those are the main ones that I would point to. Three artifacts that give us the name Jesus, the title Christ, and show him being crucified and the Christians worshiping him. And then five historical sources that talk about Jesus Christ and some of the aspects of his life.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to today's guest, Dr. Titus Kennedy, author of Archaeology and the People of the Bible, exploring the evidence for the historical existence of Bible characters. On tomorrow's program, it's Fuzz Rana on the ethics of using transhumanist technologies.
So, you know, we're surrounded by pop culture examples of transhumanism, which on one hand is good because it means that through these science fiction and fantasy you know, offerings, we've been able to wrestle through some of the implications of transhumanism. And everybody recognizes, hey, a dystopian world is just as likely, maybe more likely than a utopian world. But on the other hand, because it's so much become part of pop culture, we are desensitized to how radical an idea this is.
That's tomorrow at the same time, right here on His People. Thanks for listening.